From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, how the extreme cold over the next 2 days will affect everyone from the homeless to family pets.
We talk with the folks at Impact 211 about accessing warming centers and other city services.
An Arctic explorer gives us his best tips for staying warm despite the weather.
Plus, when it's this cold, go ahead and set your thermostat to keep your heater on all the time.
If the furnace is going to be borderline able to even keep up, if you allow it to turn off and slip those few degrees, you may not get them back. So set it to 70 and set it and forget it for the next few days.
The cold affects our pets too. Bring them inside.
Any arrangements you have made for your animal to be safe outdoors in cold weather, you didn't make them for weather like this.
And how to keep your car running when it is this cold. Lake Effect is next after the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Between the snow, the ice, and the extreme cold, there are many in the Milwaukee area seeking out social services through the 211 phone number this week. The 24-hour phone line connects people with different services depending on their needs.
Emily Kenny is the Coordinated Entry Program Director for Impact 211, the organization responsible for southeastern Wisconsin's 211 line. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about the kinds of services they can connect people to.
Because of the cold, there are more calls regarding where can I go during the day and at night. With the snow, our number one request in the last day was for snow shoveling services. We also had requests for food pantries, furnace and maintenance repair, energy assistance, those kinds of cold winter weather-related calls.
So what are the kinds of things that people can and should call you about? You just mentioned, you know, furnaces. And I wouldn't have necessarily thought, oh, my furnace is out. Maybe I should call 211. What are the kinds of things people should and can call you about?
Yeah. So we have good partnerships with community advocates and We Energies for staying warm. So anything that is related to energy assistance or furnace repair. If you own your home or are working with a landlord to make sure that that is getting fixed. Community shelters, emergency shelters, and warming rooms. And then food is our number two request. So food pantries, assistance getting, making sure that you know where to go for your food share, meal sites, those kinds of things are our top calls. We also have for Racine County, which is one of the counties that we work with, because it is tax time now, we have services to help people get to programs where volunteers can help with taxes. So really any kind of social service need, it's worth calling 211. And if there is a resource in your community, we can point you in that direction.
So if you're an elderly person or someone who just can't, for whatever reason, shovel themselves out, where do you direct those people?
So that is an emerging unmet need that we have found. So the city of Milwaukee has a small program that is new, but other than that, there isn't much in our database. It is certainly a need that we have seen that doesn't have a resource matching to it in every community.
Okay. If you live on a street that might not have been plowed by, you know, the city snow plows, do you have resources for those kinds of people?
So we can help you hook into your city or county area and ask for that to happen. So we would know who you would need to talk to have a plow come out.
Okay. As far as warming centers are concerned, I know there are some organizations that go out, you know, on the street to make sure that people are getting into those warming centers. Are we seeing them pretty full right now?
The warming centers are full, but they're not at beyond capacity. We haven't had to turn anyone away. And as you mentioned, there are volunteer and street outreach teams out in Milwaukee looking for people who might need a ride to a warming room. And we haven't turned anyone away yet, and I don't anticipate that we will. These organizations are really opening their doors and with the extreme cold want to make sure that people are safe and inside.
Yeah, of course. How many warming centers are there in the Milwaukee area?
So we've got some are in the inside a shelter. So like guest house has overflow capacity, so they have extra beds. And then we've got six other warming rooms through the Milwaukee Homeless Continuum of Care. And then there are just today, there have been groups calling 211 saying, I'm opening just for these next few days while it's extremely cold. So we're still tallying those up. So I would say we've got around nine that'll be open this week.
Okay. So people coming out of the woodwork to make sure that those who may not have a warm place to go do have some place to go.
Yes, absolutely. The church and faith communities have been great at stepping up, and then other organizations that have this at their core. So day shelters are staying open, you know, through the night as well, for example.
Beyond the warming centers and you know, the help with energy inside of people's homes, are there other things that the city is doing, that the county is doing in order to make sure the people are getting through this pretty rough patch?
The biggest thing is to make sure that you're inside and then stay inside. So if it's not safe to be out, don't go out, which is why we had the closures of everything yesterday. So the safest thing to do is really stay inside until it gets a little bit warmer. I think it is worth noting that while everything was closed, the county and city governments, non-essential personnel, Impact 211 was up and running, and we took close to 800 calls yesterday to help people get to where they needed to go. So even if other places are closed down, we are up and running 24/7.
Well, that's great to know.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. Good luck on the upcoming week. I know it's going to be really rough for Impact 211, and thank you so much for your work.
Yeah. Thanks for letting me talk about it.
Emily Kenny is the Coordinated Entry Program Director for Impact 211, the organization responsible for southeastern Wisconsin's 211 services. Kenny spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers.
For those who need to get out of the cold in the Milwaukee area, the Lyft Rideshare app is offering free rides to warming centers. There's more information at WUWM.com.
As Emily Kenny said, the best thing to do in these Arctic conditions is to stay inside, but for many of us, that simply is not an option. Delivery people, police officers, and EMTs are just some of the people whose work forces them to stay outside despite the weather.
For some, like Eric Larson, this is familiar territory. Larson is a Wisconsin native, as well as a polar adventurer, expedition guide, and educator. His work has brought him to the North and South Poles, and part of his work is teaching people how to survive in sustained periods of deep cold. Larson tells Lake Effect's Joy Powers some of his tips for working outside.
One of the most important aspects of being outside in the cold is just having the right attitude. Physically, I don't think you need to be stronger than any other person to be able to withstand severe cold. I think you just need to be smarter and have a positive attitude and understand that you can be comfortable no matter what the conditions are.
So if you're someone who is, you know, pretty uncomfortable with cold just in general, what should you be doing to prepare yourself? What kind of clothing should you be wearing? How many hats? How many pants?
Yeah, I mean, I always say that there's no such thing as cold weather, just not enough layers. And so quite honestly, the biggest thing to prepare is just having enough gear and the appropriate gear. And so I generally tend to dress in layers. And so the colder that it is, the more layers that I put on. Generally next to my skin is a light wicking layer, which helps keep moisture away from my body. And then I add several insulating layers of fleece or down, and then a shell to protect from the wind. And so again, depending on the temperatures, I can either add or subtract those layers.
So you mentioned a wicking layer. What is that for?
Well, quite honestly, the one of the biggest things that I'm always concerned about in extreme cold weather, because I'm generally working very hard, is getting too warm. Your body actually generates a lot of heat, and as soon as you overheat, you sweat, and that sweat next to your skin actually replaces the layer of insulating air that's right next to your body. And so having that wicking layer, that layer next to your skin that can pull moisture away from your body so that that warm air layer stays intact is very important.
That's something my boyfriend works for UPS. He's a UPS driver. And he mentions a lot of the time that he'll start, you know, sweating because he's lifting boxes in and out of these trucks all day. So if you have a layer that can kind of absorb that, that's a way to avoid that.
Yeah, not only absorb it, but pull it away from your body to the outer layers. And then equally important, I think I really advocate for this idea of thoughtfulness in terms of cold weather. Very easily, you can overheat, as I mentioned. And I think what's very common is that people just assume that they're going to get too hot and then they start sweating. And so I kind of advocate this idea of thoughtfulness, as I mentioned, which is really as you start getting warm, taking layers off or unzipping or putting down your hood or whatever. Jokingly, I kind of call it the polar striptease. And as I'm traveling around in whatever cold weather environment, oftentimes I'm constantly modifying my layers and making adjustments just specifically so that I don't get too warm.
What are the biggest challenges when you've, you know, dressed at the beginning of the day and you're all bundled up? What are the biggest challenges as you work through your day as far as your clothing is concerned?
I think the biggest challenges are just keeping on top of all your systems and not relaxing so that you think you're in control of the situation and the environment. I think the ways in which I've seen most people get into either dangerous situations where they've gotten severe cold injuries or frostbite or potential survival situations is when you kind of relax and think that, oh, I'm just going to be fine or I'll take care of it later. And so this kind of constant diligence to keep on top of all your systems and to keep on top of managing your layers and your body temperature is probably the most important thing that you need to be mindful of throughout the day.
If you have clothing on that is getting water into it, is there anything you can do during the day to kind of fix that, or are you just kind of stuck until you get inside?
Yeah, I mean, you can get your clothes can get wet from both the inside from you overheating and from the outside when you're kind of in snow or wet conditions. And so it is hard at times to potentially dry that gear. That said, wet gear can dry in the cold. There's a process called sublimation where, you know, a solid moves into a gas. And so there have been times, for example, in the Arctic Ocean on the way to the North Pole where we've actually fallen through the ice into the water. And what we do is just keep traveling in the hopes that our clothes will dry out as we travel. That said, I think that diligence in terms of monitoring your own layers and making sure that you're not getting any snow inside your boots or your gloves or things like that is going to just help that process of keeping dry.
Do you have any tips that people, you know, people who do work in the cold or have to be in the cold because it's just cold outside, do you have any tips that people might not think about?
Yeah, I mean, one of the biggest ways in which people lose heat in the wintertime is through their feet. And so just standing on a cold surface, you lose a lot of heat through conduction. So anything that you can do to insulate your feet from the ground is really important. Part of that might be adding an extra pair of insoles inside your boots. One of the things that you can also do if you're just simply standing in a spot for whatever reason or like ice fishing, you can stand on an insulated pad, like a foam pad, and that will actually help your feet stay warmer as well. That basic adage of putting on your hat, I think, is really important. So insulating your head. Oftentimes I see people that are cold that, you know, have their hood down and their zipper wide open. And so that's one of the first things that I tell them. I also think that, you know, one of the biggest ways to stay warm is just simply moving your body around. Your body generates a lot of heat. So if you are cold, moving around, running in place, doing jumping jacks can have a big impact as well. So there are a lot of subtle things, but, you know, overall, I think that's about it.
Yeah, when you're working with people for these expeditions, people who I'm guessing certainly aren't as experienced as you are with the extreme cold, are there things that tend to come up?
Yeah, I mean, I think the basic things that come up with everybody are just cold hands, cold feet. I think people are very concerned just about being outside all day. And oftentimes on my expeditions, we're outside in extreme cold, 30, 40, 50 below for, you know, 10 or 12 hours a day. And so I think just being out for that long is very intimidating while trying to manage, doing anything with their hands or feet or whatever. And so I think the hands thing is a real big issue. For me, I'm a big advocate of mittens over gloves, although I do use a lot of gloves in occasions as well. So there are a lot of these little tips that I think add to your ability to stay warm.
I've seen people doing things like putting surgical gloves underneath, you know, their mittens or like plastic bags in their shoes.
Yeah, I mean that those things are called vapor barriers, and so the idea behind like plastic surgical gloves on your hands is that moisture doesn't get into your gloves or your mittens, and so that can work at times. You have to have a little bit more skill to make sure that you're being safe with that. Plastic bags on your feet is the same thing. I often have used that principle, and actually on our expeditions we'll actually use just plastic bags from the grocery store as vapor barriers to help keep our feet warm.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing so much information.
No problem. Good luck.
Eric Larson is a polar adventurer, expedition guide, and educator whose work has brought him to the North and South Poles, as well as Mount Everest. Larson is a Wisconsin native who spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers by Skype from his home in Colorado.
We will take a short break to warm up and then be back with how the cold affects your furnace and the building around it. You're listening to Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Before the break, we talked about how the cold affects people, but it also has an impact on mechanical systems. If you're fortunate enough to get to spend the day at home today, or if you have children or pets who will be in your house or apartment throughout the cold snap, you'll want to make sure that your heating system is doing everything it can to keep your home warm. And on the coldest days, the furnace can run for a long time and sometimes still not reach the temperature on the thermostat.
So is that a problem? We reached someone who knows a thing or two about heating systems. David Stewart is an environmental systems technician instructor, part of the Sheet Metal Apprenticeship Program with Sheet Metal Workers Local 18 and Milwaukee Area Technical College. Dave Stewart, thanks for taking a few minutes to talk.
My pleasure.
Well, so let me ask you maybe an obvious question that a lot of us are thinking about. What should we realistically expect our furnace to be able to accomplish on a night when it is 25 below zero, or for that matter, a day when the temperature isn't expected to get above 12 below?
Okay. Well, that is a good question. I would say the biggest thing to expect is actually that your furnace should probably not even shut off. Your furnace was sized for a day to keep your house warm on a day that is, depending on where you live, either zero or negative 10 degrees. So when we see temperatures that actually dip below that, your furnace should run continuously, nonstop. Now, overnight, when we hit these really, really low temperatures and the wind picks up, it may even be possible that your furnace doesn't even keep up. Where if you set your thermostat to, say, 70 degrees, you may slip down into 68, 67, 66 degrees, quite possibly. Don't be alarmed. It's doing everything it can, but it's just not quite big enough for these extreme low temperatures like this.
So this isn't a function of our furnace starting to go bad. This is just a question of our furnace not being able to keep up with how cold it is outside and whatever, you know, air leaks we might have from the outside to the inside.
Exactly.
Well, and of course, most days when we head to work, we probably have our thermostats either set or we manually set them to turn them down while we're out of the house. On a day that is as cold as the ones we are experiencing, does it behoove us to leave the furnace set to where it would normally be while we're in the house?
That is a great question. That is exactly what I would recommend is setting your thermostat to, say, 70 degrees and leaving it there for these next few days. you know, probably even through Thursday, you know, until those temperatures get back up above zero, letting your furnace run is probably going to be your best bet. Again, if the furnace is probably going to be borderline able to even keep up, if you allow it to turn off and slip those few degrees, you may not get them back. So, absolutely. Set it to 70 and set it and forget it for the next few days.
Are there, you know, you mentioned that our furnaces might just be running nonstop for a couple of days here. Are there any dangers of furnaces giving out because they are running for so long?
Well, honestly, most things mechanical fail after they finally turn off. So while they're running, the likelihood of them failing while they're running is actually not too bad. It would be more so when it finally does warm up. I see like Sunday they're calling for 40. So that'll be times when your furnace will finally get to stop and take a break, and it may just want to decide not to come back on after that. As long as your furnace has been checked out by a reputable contractor, there should not be really any worries. A couple things that a homeowner could do to help their furnace would be to make sure it's got a clean filter in it. If it's going to be running constantly, it needs to move that air across the heat exchanger. If your furnace filter is dirty, it restricts its ability to do that, and it reduces its ability to get rid of that heat. You want the heat in the house, not in the furnace. And if your furnace filter is too dirty, your furnace could actually shut off on a safety, saying, hey, I've gotten too much heat built up. I need to get rid of this heat before I allow the burner to come back on again. Another thing for those that have a high-efficiency furnace would be to make sure that your intake pipe is clear. With the high winds and the snow that we got, you want to make sure that it doesn't get covered up with snow and cause the furnace to shut off that way either.
How often should we be changing our furnace filter, and how often do we need it to be checked out by a service person?
Well, I would certainly recommend an annual clean and check or an inspection from a furnace individual. They will go through, do all the safety checks, but also make some fine adjustments, if you will, make sure it's running as good as it possibly can. Your furnace filter, that can actually vary depending on how often you run your system and what kind of filter you have. A good rule of thumb would be every 90 days to at least give it a check and see what kind of condition it is.
Well, we will all keep our fingers crossed that that our furnaces can mostly keep up with the cold, and that when they finally shut off this weekend, they come back on again. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Stay warm.
You too.
Dave Stewart is an environmental systems technician instructor, part of the Sheet Metal Apprenticeship Program with Sheet Metal Workers Local 18 and Milwaukee Area Technical College.
One little piece of trivia we might mention at this point, the convector radiator, which warmed houses and apartments for generations and still does in some buildings, was invented in the 1920s in Wisconsin by La Crosse native Reuben Train, who, with his father James, went on to found the Train Company, which makes furnaces and air conditioning systems.
And we are very glad they do. So furnace and heating expert Dave Stewart told us about keeping the inside of your home warm in the Arctic chill, but buildings and other structures themselves can face distinct challenges in prolonged periods of below-zero weather as well.
Back in 2014, we spoke with Charles Ryerson about how cold and ice affect superstructures. He's with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Cold Regions Research and Engineering Laboratory in Hanover, New Hampshire, and he joined us from his office there to explain why cold and ice are subjects of scientific interest.
The majority of us on the planet in the mid-latitudes and farther poleward experience winter. And winter we all live with and tolerate, but it has its costs and its hazards and its use of energy and its effect on human health and on effect on the economics of how we do things. And so it has a very high cost. And as I say, we tolerate it because it's something we have to live with. And surprisingly, there's not more done with it than is research-wise than there is, frankly.
Well, and so we hear a lot about engineering in, say, hurricane or earthquake-prone areas. But let's talk about the particular engineering challenges in a place like Milwaukee or another northern kind of city in which there's a frequent freeze-thaw cycle, and it can get down to 10 below or 20 below or even colder than that. What are the engineering challenges to structures like buildings or bridges or other large man-made objects?
Well, initially, of course, the foundations have to be built to withstand soil freeze-thaw on heaving of the soil and migration of moisture, which forms frost lenses, which those of you in the northern latitudes, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, we had this problem. Potholes forming in roads where water migrates up because of the freezing and forms a lens, and then, and of course, it expands and breaks the pavement away. So the first thing you have to deal with is a foundation. And then, of course, once the structure is built, hopefully on an appropriate foundation, then you have problems of icing and snow formation on power lines, for example, on tall towers, tall buildings. For example, the new 1776 tower that was built in New York had quite a bit of There was quite a bit of concern about ice formation on that structure and of falling to the pavement and being a hazard to people. So structures accumulate ice, for example, from either freezing rain or snow from rime ice, or sometimes even from snow that you'll get freeze-thaw cycles, as you mentioned earlier, and water will run down into a crotch, let's say, where two structural members come together. It'll form a chunk of ice that may be the size of a baseball. And if that falls then 500 feet to the ground and it weighs a pound or two, it can be lethal, actually.
Is there anything that you can do to engineer a building or a bridge to keep that ice from forming or to mitigate how it falls?
Actually, design can be a fairly significant way to deal with ice, but it all depends on the kind of ice that's going to form. If you have ice that forms from freezing rain or snow, it's pretty difficult because freezing rain or snow will land on and stick to just about anything. If you have in-cloud icing, so let's say you have a fog that forms and you have tiny cloud droplets that are 20 microns in diameter, then airflow causes them to either strike an object and freeze and cause ice to grow into the wind, or the droplets will pass around it. And as it, this seems counterintuitive, but larger diameter objects ice less than smaller diameter objects because water droplets in clouds or fog will tend to flow around larger diameter objects, but they'll tend to collide with smaller diameter objects and freeze.
Huh. So we've heard about these ships in the Antarctic region trapped in the ice, which is obviously a consistent problem in that part of the world. But how do bodies of water like the Great Lakes ice up in comparison to sea ice? And what are the unique problems that icing on the Great Lakes might cause to ships and other structures on the lake?
Well, any, we'll call it a seagoing vehicle or a vehicle that's out in the ocean. So now we're talking about offshore platforms in the oil industry or ships will ice if spray is created either by waves or by, in the case of a ship, its bow plunging into the seas. So in the ocean, we have salt water, and the typical salinity of salt water is about 33 parts per thousand, fairly high, high enough that the freezing point is depressed by a couple of degrees Fahrenheit. And when the water lands on the vessel, in particular, the large amounts of water to land on a ship, the water will freeze. But water doesn't freeze with salt in it. So what happens is that the water freezes, it excludes the salt and causes it to be concentrated in what we call brine pockets. And those brine pockets weaken the ice.
But this is why people, you know, use salt to break up ice on the roads, for example.
That's right. But in the Great Lakes, we have fresh water. And freshwater ice freezes, of course, at 32 Fahrenheit. And it doesn't have salt in it. And as a result, it forms clear ice. And it's much harder and much more tenacious in the sense that its adhesion strength to substrates, to decks, to railings, to whatever on a ship is much, much stronger. So when the Coast Guard goes out with their small icebreakers and tries to either do search and rescue or create passages for ships, they experience superstructure icing. Now, they don't experience it when they're breaking ice. The floating ice suppresses the waves and you don't get any spray. But if they're in transit, let's say between Sheboygan, Cross Lake, Michigan, when they're in the open lake, the spray will form on the ship. The bow, the bow generates spray, then that passes up over the ship. And it can be sufficient to cause so much weight and such an increase in the height of the center of gravity of the ship that it'll founder, it'll roll over and sink. Fortunately, we haven't lost a Coast Guard cutter that way, I don't think, since the Second World War, and that was in the Atlantic. But fishing trawlers are lost every year. I don't know what the current statistics are, but those that watch reality television have seen crabbing boats certainly ice up, and the technology we use to de-ice them today is what we've used for the last several hundred years, probably, and that's mallets and things like baseball bats.
Well, and so this brings us back to our initial question about the key reasons you study cold and ice. Is this an issue that people are taking on, better ways to de-ice a freshwater ship?
To de-ice any ship, freshwater or saltwater, is a significant problem, and right now it's being looked at pretty carefully because the Arctic Ocean is opening up. And as the Arctic Ocean opens up, there'll probably be more activity up there, commercial activity, tour boats, maybe military activity, we don't know. As a result, the Coast Guard is going to have a much more active presence, at least off the north coast of Alaska. And they'll be pushing the envelope in the sense of the edges of the season. In the late fall, early winter are the most dangerous times up there for superstructure icing, as we call it. And so the goal is to try to develop better ways to either prevent icing on ships and offshore platforms or to remove it without having to send people out on deck with baseball bats or whatever and to break it off. Because now you have people out in the elements on a rolling ship, on a icy deck, swinging mallets, and it's a pretty serious thing to have to ask people to do in those conditions. The problem with icing is that most of the times it doesn't sink ships, but it is a safety hazard to the ship because the anchoring hardware is frozen in, navigation aids are frozen in, sometimes the radars become frozen, antennas ice over and they can't communicate effectively, and so most of the time, it's a hazard, we'll call it a safety hazard, rather than a threat to life, but it can easily become a threat to life.
Well, Charles Ryerson, thanks so much for helping shed some light on this issue for us.
Thank you very much, Mitch. Nice to talk to you.
Charles Ryerson is with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Cold Regions Research and Engineering Laboratory in Hanover, New Hampshire, back in my old stomping grounds, where we reached him back in 2014.
We will take one last break and then talk with auto contributor Mark Savage about how the cold affects your car and with the Wisconsin Humane Society about how to protect your pets and other animals. Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM.
You're as cold as ice. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. People, furnaces, buildings, bridges, all are adversely affected by extreme cold. And so are cars.
Those of us of a certain age who grew up in cold climates, such as the Northeast or the Upper Midwest, remember installing engine block or oil pan heaters to make starting the car at least possible on a 40 below zero morning.
Then there were the days when the school buses couldn't come because the diesel fuel had frozen. Regular Lake Effect Automotive contributor Mark Savage joins Audrey Nowakowski now to give us some tips on getting and keeping our vehicles running in extreme cold.
Mark Savage, welcome back to Lake Effect. Thanks for taking a few minutes to talk. Absolutely.
So in Wisconsin, it's not just cold, it's becoming frigid, and it's something we haven't quite experienced before. And one thing a lot of people are concerned about is transportation, whether they are taking city buses or driving their cars. So just to start, what are some good tips, you know, safety-wise, mechanical-wise, that people should keep in mind with this cold weather?
Well, I guess the first thing is, if you can put your car in a garage, that's a great thing because it keeps it out of the wind and probably keeps it any, you know, even if it's just a normal non-insulated garage, probably 10 to 15 degrees warmer. So that's the first step. When you start it up, obviously make sure the garage door is open, but, you know, let it run for at least 30 seconds. Let the fluids get mixed around as there, as you want the oil to be coating all the parts that it needs to coat so that you don't hurt your engine. And, you know, obviously drive normally after that, or at least according to the conditions. But key thing here is if you have a newer car, you're going to notice that your check tire light will come on, because as cold weather, especially severe cold weather like we're looking at right now, the air kind of escapes from your tires a little bit, so you're going to lose a pound or two of pressure. I wouldn't worry about it too much unless, you know, you look at your tires and definitely something is a lot lower, then maybe add a little bit too, but don't overinflate, because once it warms up, then the tires will get some of the air back into them. The, you know, the warmth will warm it back up and expand the air. Always have a good battery. Those people who have had bad batteries over the last year or so and have not replaced them, this is the time it should have been replaced by. otherwise, you're going to have trouble starting the car. Because if you can get the battery to fire, really most everything else tends to work after that. You just got to get that little electrical charge in there to get everything fired up. And I think everybody always says, you know, keep liquids topped off and try not to let your gas go below a half a tank and things like that. And I'm sure there's some science behind some of that, but I think it's also just to be cautionary in case you do get stuck someplace.
Now, for everyone in the city that, say, does have to keep their car parked outside, or when you're at work, you're in an exposed open parking lot, should you take any other precautions, you know, perhaps besides having a shovel in your car and some other things like that? But should we let our cars run a bit longer when it comes to leaving it exposed outdoors for prolonged periods of time before we start driving?
Well, I always think it's good to let it run for a little bit, and you almost have to use your own sense on that. Now there's remote starts. It's nice if you can stand inside and start it and let it go for the minute or two till you get out to it. But I think, you know, you have to watch and see if that heat gauge for the engine heat starts to move a little bit. Then you know that things certainly are fine. In severe weather, maybe you're going to let it go for a minute or two before you start driving, but most of the time it just needs to get the fluids moving and not just start it up, throw the car into reverse and get going, because things are still a little bit sticky probably at that point as far as the lubricants that are inside.
Now, would that make a difference? You know, say my car, I got it a couple years ago. It's a newer Nissan Rogue. I'm leaving it outside all day in an open parking lot while I'm working. Does it matter with the fluids and the way precautions should be taken with my car versus someone who is, say, you know, driving an older car that does not have the same engine setups that these newer cars have?
Well, it could be difficult for either one. And why I say that is some of the newer cars, there's so much electronics on them. You never know when maybe the cold weather might affect some of that electronics and therefore make it run differently or make it not want to start because, you know, some little computer chip has blown its brains out because it's a daggone cold. Now, you know, the car makers test all these things and they put them through severe traumas and so forth. But, you know, this is, when it's cold, anything that could be bad could happen is much more likely to happen. So you just want to be careful. And again, don't put extra stress on your car. Try to avoid big bumps when you see them. You don't need to give an extra shock to your shock absorber or springs. Just try and drive a little more carefully. And then if you're parking in a parking lot, one of the things I suggest to folks, if it's possible, is do not park with your nose of your car into the wind, because it tends to, that wind chill that you're feeling, your car is feeling it too. So, you know, park away from the wind if possible, or if there's a building and you can park on one side of it and that protects you a little from the wind, that's a good thing. And I know a lot of people, when it snows and so forth, they raise the windshield wipers so they don't get stuck to the windows. And that's the practical thing, especially if it's snowing. When it's just cold like this, I don't think that matters too much. Maybe carry a rag in your car that you could, you know, maybe a little liquid antifreeze for the windows that you can maybe pour something on if it's already gotten too smeared and it's just not clearing for you because you want to have good visibility. So that's not a bad thing to have. You know, they always tell you to take a blanket and have things like that in the car. None of that's bad. I don't think it's very practical for most of us because we just don't think that way. It's like, well, I'm only going 2 miles or 10 miles or whatever. And then, you know, if you got an old car, anything you can do to replace, especially belts or things that are going to get more brittle the colder it gets. So a lot of this is preventive maintenance, and probably we should have been talking about this a week or two ago.
But, right, now it's not going to help much.
But at least be aware of that. And that's another thing is when you start the car, those belts are brittle. And, you know, maybe if you don't put a lot of stress on them right away by going extra fast or backing out right away, then you're going to be fine. And, you know, you just don't want to put a lot of stress on them and break that belt right away. Then you do have problems.
Right. We're kind of past the days of having block heaters or dipstick heaters for our cars. So we just need to be a little more gentle, I suppose.
Right. There's still a few folks, I suppose, that have those. And that would be wonderful to have at this time of the year. But it's not very common. And I guess the other thing I would say is if people talk about diesels sometimes at this time of the year. And while sometimes they are a little harder to crank over, once you get them running, they are, you know, like bulletproof this time of the year. So if you live in a really cold climate, sometimes you leave that diesel run all night. And I know that sounds crazy, but I've known from many of my snowmobiling friends that live up in northern Minnesota in the UP that, you know, you lock the car up at night and leave the thing running so that the thing is guaranteed to, and especially usually trucks, guaranteed to be running in the morning when you get out there and are challenged by these, you know, minus 10 and 20 and 30 degree temperatures.
Does that burn a lot of fuel if you're leaving it run overnight but not necessarily moving?
Well, it obviously burns fuel, but it is not a dramatic amount because it is a diesel and they're very efficient in how they, you know, burn the fuel oil anyway. So this is probably not the time of the year that people should be worrying quite as much personally about the environment and their car, because the environment has already tossed you a bad scene by giving you a 20 below temperature or whatever. So, you know, do what it takes to survive and make sure you get to where you need to go or to get indoors and stay safe.
Excellent. Great advice. Well, Mark, thanks very much.
All right. Thanks for talking.
Mark Savage writes about cars on his website, Savage on Wheels, and starting this weekend, his column will appear at WUWM.com. He is a regular contributor to Lake Effect as well.
We've been talking about the toll such severe cold has on humans and human structures, but it also has a profound effect on other animals, whether wild or domesticated. So we invited a couple of folks from the Wisconsin Humane Society over to talk about how to safeguard our pets and other animals that may be part of our lives.
Ann Reed is the organization's president and CEO, and Crystal Charlo Schaefer is a member of WHS's wildlife rehab team. Reed says the best thing we can do for our pets in this kind of weather is to keep them inside.
It's by far the biggest thing. There are lots of other things that we can talk about, but the biggest thing is to, no matter what your dog tells you in terms of exercise, keep that being outside long enough to go to the bathroom and right back in. No matter what your cat tells you about how much they like to be outdoors, indoors is the place for a cat to be. It's just as it's actively dangerous for humans, it's actively dangerous for them to be outdoors. So we're
so
inside.
So anyone who might have like an outside doghouse, don't use it.
Don't. It's absolutely too cold by far. You know, I'm smiling a little because today, as we're taping this, today's the warm day. It's up to 3 degrees and it's all of minus 19 in wind chill. And that obviously feels very cold to us. Wednesday and Thursday are going to be interplanetary cold. Any arrangements you have made for your animal to be safe outdoors in cold weather, you didn't make them for weather like this. Indoors is the place for your animal to be.
So, Crystal, for people who might have chickens, say, mm-hmm. in their backyards, because that's something that people can have urban, not really farms, but animals that don't normally come inside, they're not normally pets. What do you do?
So for chicken coops, hopefully when you built or designed your chicken coop, you had winter weather in mind, meaning that it's insulated, it's protected from drafts and things like that. now, anticipating this cold weather, if at all possible, insulate it even more, use appropriate bedding. You can also offer supplemental heat by using a heat lamp. Just be really careful that you don't have any bedding touch that lamp. Those lamps are very hot. It's also important that they have access to fresh water. So you can get electric heated dog bowls, and I know chickens are going to step in that, so make sure that's clean and change it regularly. But that's something you have to take into consideration when you have a little group of chickens, is that they will definitely be affected by the weather.
Is there thought that maybe even putting something over the top of the coop, like, you know, the idea of putting a quilt even, or some kind of something over to help with insulation temporarily when it's this bitterly cold?
Yeah, I don't know the effectiveness of just a quilt. Certainly it will do some degree. Frequently people will use large straw bales and brace those against the outsides of their coops. But this is something to consider as well, especially with more municipalities approving urban chickens. Take winter weather into consideration when designing your coop for the future.
So, Anne, despite your best efforts, say your dog goes out longer than it should have and comes in with frozen paws. Mm-hmm. What do you do?
You're calling the vet. So for frostbite, you're looking for discoloration, especially on the skin. You're looking for blisters and swelling. Your animal obviously has ways of letting you know they're in pain. For hypothermia, you're looking for shivering and trembling. You're looking for lethargy. Is your animal cold to the touch? Some things might look a little neurological, like trouble walking. If you're concerned, you're calling your vet, you're getting in there. We expect that emergency vets will be getting a lot of calls during this time. So those are the things you're looking for.
What can you do between the time you notice your pet not behaving correctly and getting it to the vet? I mean, is it good to wrap them in warm towels and that sort of thing?
Best thing is definitely to wrap in a blanket. For frostbite, we're advising don't immerse in hot water. Don't rub. That skin is quite delicate. But wrapping in a warm blanket on your way to the vet and getting over there is the thing to do.
So paws obviously are the thing that's most affected. What about things like noses and tails?
Yep, and ears.
Ears.
Now, paws are protectable. If your dog will wear those boots, they're great. And we also recommend just something like Vaseline, some other sort of thing to put on those paws. And this actually brings up another point that Crystal and I were actually talking about this morning, which is the things that are hard right now to do, like, oh, my dog doesn't want to put on those boots, or, oh, my dog won't go to the bathroom outside, which we have another tip for, or my cat just won't want to stay in. Just say, all right, I'm caught up short this time. I'm going to have a rough couple of days managing this. I'm going to now start the things that are going to make this easier the next time. So we're going to start little pieces of hot dog and boots when you don't need them, so that it'll be easier the next time.
So talk about the going to the bathroom.
Yeah,
how do you get that to happen? Because obviously they need to.
A friend of mine posted on Facebook last night a picture of the track her dog had made through a foot of snow to get, not in the way they had shoveled for that dog, but that dog wanted to go to a specific spot. It was really funny, like a little tunnel. One kind of call we get a lot is dogs just don't want to go to the bathroom on the snow. And one trick that we're finding that's really helpful for people is to get hold of some hay at your farm supply store, or maybe your neighbor has some, and spread that out. Shovel a space and spread that out so you have a little non-snow spot outside your house. And that's been helpful for a lot of people.
Well, also the hay, I think, would protect for the cold, too. It makes them want to stand there long enough to actually defecate.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's a little bit warmer.
Any other tips that we should be giving pet owners?
You know, ID tags and chip are, and it's, you know, too late to get the chip for tomorrow, but making sure that your animals are wearing tags so that if they do get out and somebody sees them, they can act quickly. Never leave an animal in the car is a big one. Same thing in the summer. That's a lot less safe than we think it is. And one tip we're giving out a lot is before you start your car, a wild animal or a cat might be in there somewhere to seek warmth. So honk the horn, bang on the hood, exactly,
yeah.
and be sure you're not hurting an animal who's in there.
So, Crystal, speaking of wildlife, and that's where you work with the Wisconsin Humane Society, what if somebody finds an animal in their backyard that is a wild animal but is obviously stressed or frozen? What do you do?
Yeah, well, we are there. We're here at the Wisconsin Humane Society Wildlife Rehabilitation Center 365 days a year. So certainly you can call us. We always want to counsel you first. We also have information on our website about what to do, because each different species is going to have different things to do for safety, for human safety, for animal safety. But if you find an animal that you believe may be sick or injured, call us. Definitely call us. We are there. That's what we're there for.
So don't try to intervene on your own without calling you first.
We always like you to call us first, and then we can direct you just for human safety and for animal safety.
The rabbits and foxes and birds are all going to be affected by this extreme cold as well.
And all so, in different ways. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, all I can say is, ladies, thank you so much. Stay warm.
You
over
too,
these
Bonnie.
Next couple of days, and I really appreciate you coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Ann Reed is the president and CEO of the Wisconsin Humane Society. Crystal Charlotte Schaefer is a member of WHS's wildlife rehab team. There's more information at WUWM.com. That is today's somewhat chilly edition. We're always cool here, but it is a cool addition to the show. Hopefully you are listening to it somewhere warm. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Do be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay warm and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.